Forward Guidance is brought to you by Van Eck, a global leader in asset management since 1955. You'll be hearing more about Van Eck ETFs later on, but for now, let's get into today's interview. I am joined by Mark Dow. He is known as a veteran trader, macro investor, and risk manager, and he's also known for his commentary on Twitter. Mark, it's wonderful to meet you for the first time. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me. It's nice to meet you too. I'm doing doing well.
Glad to hear it. Marcus, the first topic I want to discuss is something I think our audience here today is going to be really interested in, which is how much monetary policy matters. The Federal Reserve has many tools, but the two primary tools are controlling the price of money and the quantity of money. Price of money being interest rates, quantity of money within the banking system. It now changes quantitative easing, quantitative tightening is reducing its balance sheet. So in the beginning of 2022, the Federal Reserve started to raise interest rates, and it's a few months later, it started to reduce its balance sheet. And those are typically seen as monetary tightening techniques. And you know, many in the financial world and many economists, and this is really mainstream, predicted a recession and a bear market in stocks. We got a mild bear market in stocks, maybe 25% down the S&P, obviously didn't feel mild at the time. But we never got the recession, maybe a slight economic slowdown, but really had a reacceleration last year as inflation fell down, as you know. So I just want to say, can you share your thesis on how much monetary policy actually matters? I mean, were the people who thought that the Fed would cause a bear market, were they wrong and why?
Yeah, so I was one of the ones, as you know, said that monetary policy matters less than we think it does. It's not that it doesn't matter, but it tends to get swamped by other factors. And there's a good empirical basis. It's extremely counterintuitive because you think, oh, lower price of money, people are going to borrow, and they're going to take lower opportunity costs, they're going to take more risk and discounted cash flows and all that kind of stuff. So it's very intuitive. But in reality, there's a lot of empirical evidence to suggest that matters a lot less than other factors. Typically, human factors, behavioral factors, animal spirit factors, they tend to be cyclical. So if you look back just to start off at 2000, the biggest bubble in my lifetime with the highest valuations, going into it, Fed funds was at 5% and the 10-year was at 7%. And we didn't know what QE was. We didn't even pay any attention to the Fed balance sheet. Running into 2008, the global financial crisis, that for the three preceding years, that's when we had the highest quantity and most egregious quality of mortgages minted in that cycle. And the Fed funds rate was on average 5%, and we didn't know what QE was. So everyone says, well, it makes sense to me if you're lowering rates that people should take more risk. But why would a lender want to lend more at lower rates? That's the part that really should make people stop and ask questions. So it just doesn't matter as much as people think it does because they don't think through the mechanism. The quote I always cite is that one from J.P. Morgan, the famous banker, who said, "Nothing so undermines a man's financial judgment as seeing his neighbor get rich." And then Hyman Minsky, who I'm sure you've heard of, also has a thesis that it's called the financial instability hypothesis. And basically, it means stability breeds instability. When you can lead a banker to liquidity, but you can't make them lend, that's the problem. So if your balance sheet is bad, or you don't feel like you're in a good position, you're not going to take risk no matter how low the interest rate is. You're just not going to do it. And late in the cycle, even if rates are high, if you think you're going to make 200% or 300% on your house or on your coin or whatever the speculative vehicle happens to be, you don't care if the policy rate is 1 or 3 or 5. It's the same number to you. So those, I'm not saying that the rates don't matter, is that they get swamped by these other factors: fear, greed, economic expectations. And that's what we've seen. Now, there are cyclical and secular reasons why monetary policy is less powerful than people think, right? The secular ones are the global monetary system has changed. The global financialization has led to insurance companies in Brazil, where there used to not be, or financial entities around the world, really, that didn't exist before. And guess what? They all need regulatory capital, right? And regulatory capital sometimes takes the form of U.S. assets. We also have the explosion of the euro dollar market and the repo markets. Now people fund themselves through the shadow banking system much more than they used to. The Fed doesn't have control over, or at least not direct control, and certainly not regulatory oversight over much of the shadow banking system. And then lastly, the financial markets have developed to such a point that people can borrow. So, and this is also goes to why the yield inverted yield curve wasn't a good signal, or at least a trustworthy signal. Now, through swaps markets and maturity transformation with derivatives, you can lend at the 10-year mark, and you can borrow to fund that lending at the 10-year mark. So it's not like you're borrowing short to lend long, the classic maturity transformation capital creation scenario.
You're borrowing where and lending where?
Well, you can borrow at the point you lend. So you can borrow at the 10-year point. If you want to lend to Bank X, if Bank X wants to lend to entity Y, the bank lends a 10-year loan to the company, Y, and then it says, and then it goes and funds whatever the cheapest point is on the curve, and then they can use swaps to transform the maturity into a length that matches the duration of the loan. So they're not taking the classic interest rate risk. They're lending on spread. Because of these structural changes, the Fed has a lot less control over the global money supply, as it were. And you said something in your introduction about how the Fed can control the price of money, but then control the quantity. They can't really control the quantity. They can control the quantity in the settlement system. But the bulk of the money in our system is issued by chartered banks and shadow banks. They're the ones who create the bulk of the money, right? And you don't need reserves to lend. You know the mechanism. A bank says, I want to lend to Jack, and they lend to you. At the same time, they credit your deposit account with funds, the same amount, right? They've just created money. They didn't need reserves to do that. All they needed is to be within their ratios for adequate capitalization, adequate liquidity, leverage, all those the prudential ratios. If they're within those, and these days banks are obviously, then they can lend and they can create and they can create money. So the bulk of it is that. Now in crisis, that shuts down because everybody becomes risk averse, right? And that's where the Fed will matter, because they come in to make sure. And typically when that happens, people say, "Oh, I want cash now because I'm less sure. I'm going to sell treasuries and take cash," right? Because treasuries settle T plus one. And Fed funds settle on the same day. So if you worried about the demands on your liquidity because there's some kind of shock to the system, we can imagine the COVID shock in March 2020. Everybody wants cash all of a sudden. The system needs elasticity to respond to that, and the Fed steps in, short circuits the panic, and provides that liquidity. So for those rare instances in crisis, yes, the Fed provides supplies money, as it were, but really for the humming of the economy, for the functioning of things, really it's the banks and the shadow banks that provide credit, and they don't need the Fed as long as they're in within their prudential limits. They're not 33 times levered the way Lehman was going into to 2007, 2008. So those are the secular reasons why the Fed has less control over the money supply, and interest rates matter less. From a cyclical point of view, we know the story a little bit better there. It's been fleshed out. Some of us were talking about it way back when, but we came into this with better balance sheets. Fiscal support made those balance sheets better, right? So, you can't commit suicide jumping out of the basement window. Our balance sheets were in good shape. The way we get recessions, Jack, and the nasty kind of cascading unwinds of risk that a lot of people had in their minds going into the end of this cycle, as it were, is everyone has borrowed too much, and they've hired too much, and they're out over their skis, and they're taking a lot of risk because they're excessively optimistic about the future. And all of a sudden something happens to change that worldview. It can be anything. And the more extended you are, the smaller the event needs to be to trigger it. The trigger can be anything. And then people say, oh, geez, I need to reel things back in. I need to fire people. I need to sell assets to bring down my leverage. And then it starts to feed on itself. And the speed of it scares other people. They do the same thing. And you get that cascading, that chain effect. Well, if you're not that far out over your skis, if you're not on margin when the stock market tanks 2%, you're not worried. But if you're margined up to the hilt, you're going to say, oh, geez, I better liquidate something, right? That kind of mindset. So that works at the economy level too. So we were in better shape going in terms of our balance sheets, and fiscal policy made it even stronger. We were leaning the wrong way, a lot of us, because we read Milton Friedman and we've heard about yield curve inversions and all these traditional things that don't really work that great in the modern economy. So people were bracing for it, and they were looking at past precedents, but they weren't there. They weren't applicable, at least, because this was such a sui generis situation. So the major lesson people should take, I think, from this cycle, if you want to call it that. For me, we're in a new cycle. The old cycle ended in October 2022, the risk cycle. But the lesson we should take away from that is the importance of initial conditions to the transmission mechanism of monetary policy. People just said, oh, 3 out of the last 4 recessions this happened, and they start talking about historical. It doesn't matter. What matters is what is your state going in, right? And in this particular case, the private sector, the financials, both households, corporations, and the financial sector were in good shape. So to get back to one last little thing is, you can see this too in the way people take risk. Like I was saying, it makes sense why people would borrow more when other things equal, when interest rates are low. But why would people lend more? When you look back at every single cycle, has this characteristic. It starts with wide spreads and people not wanting to lend. Higher rates, typically high spreads, people not wanting to lend, and it ends with much tighter spreads and everybody wanting to lend. Why does that happen? That can't happen unless the process is driven by something much more important than price. And that's really the essence of why I think people got this wrong. They were focusing too much on price, and we can talk about QE in a minute, QT, and the Fed, and not enough on behavior and initial conditions.
Basically, there are tons of things that matter at least as much or more than monetary policy. And there are plenty of examples throughout your career and throughout history of interest rates being at 6% and there being a bubble in the stock market. And likewise, interest rates being at 0% in Europe over the past 10 years. And stock market there hasn't been doing so great. So there are plenty of counterfactuals. And yeah, I think on the equity valuation side, I actually think it is rational to feature interest rates heavily in how you value stock markets, but everyone is not rational. So I think the valuation school of discounted cash flows is very much influenced by interest rates. And, you could get a 50 price to earnings ratio or 40 price to earnings ratio is extremely justifiable when interest rates are at zero. And if they go from 0 to 5%.
In theory. Yeah. I agree with you. In practice, it doesn't matter.
Yes, I agree with you.
In practice, it doesn't matter. And then some of the behavior got outright silly with it. It gets back to overestimating how rational we are. And some of that is kind of self-serving for us because we're in markets. We want to think we're smart. We want to think, that we're the master of the universe. There's that, conceit. We don't want to say, oh, we're just monkeys flipping coins and trading sardines. There's a bit of that, but it's just a lot less rational than we make it out to be. Remember the long duration asset, that whole story. I'm not saying that discounted earnings don't increase when interest rates go down. Of course they do. I'm just saying it doesn't matter nearly as much as hearing from your friend that he just bought altcoin or something like that, and he's dumber than you are, and he's making a lot of money. So I'm going to do it with even more leverage and make more money. That kind of at a very gut level, it's kind of ridiculous to call stocks long duration assets because they're not long in duration in theory. It's the uncertainty, the uncertainty of future earnings. Let's just take Nvidia. They're projected to double their earnings next year, and maybe they will. And that's fine. But a small change in that, and keeping valuations the same, is much, much more powerful to the price than 100 basis point change in the discount rate. Because you don't know what those, the rule in finance is the discount rate matters more the more certain the cash flows, right? Mm-hmm. And in a growth company, they're uncertain, not because the company is not valid. It's because the growth rate could be 100% or it can be 50. Or if you take the other extreme, a distressed company, you buy a distressed company. You don't care what the discount, the 10-year treasury rate is. All you care about, are they going to make it? So the more uncertain the cash flows, the more you focus on the idiosyncratic risk or growth risk or what have you, and the less you focus on the discount rate. Well, tech stocks are the ones that are the most volatile when it comes to the ARK type names. You know, half of them aren't going to exist within 5 years. So why would the discount rate even matter? It's yes or no. It's either it's going to work or it isn't. And if you focus on that, you'll make money. For the names like the mega cap techs, the other category that people sometimes refer to as long duration assets. Well, we have the evidence of look at what's happened to them, and rates of, you know, long-term rates have gone up 300 basis points. But also there, the uncertainty is not so much as an ongoing enterprise. The uncertainty there is the growth rate. I mean, Apple's growth rate has slowed down a lot, right? But has these things change, and that matters more to these stocks than what happens to the treasury rate. So it was kind of one of those things. It's that post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy where this happened and that happened, therefore this must have caused that. We have a lot of that thinking, and I think there's a lot of that thinking in QE, QE as well. But there's just a lot of thinking that leads that we convince ourselves that we're much more rational than we are, and that's why I have my whole behavioral macro setup to help guys trade, thinking in terms of narratives, thinking in terms of risk structure, thinking in terms of revealed preferences rather than economic theory.
I definitely think I'm a lot more rational than I actually am. So I want to ask you about...
We all do, Jack. We all do.
Okay, I'm glad. The impact of interest rates on the economy and the creation of credit, both the demand and the supply, wouldn't you say that when interest rates collapse like they did in March of 2020 or in 2003, for example, and there typically is a refinancing boom and it begins a new cycle, a financing boom or a refinancing boom. And, yeah, you know, if you had a 7% mortgage and then you can get one for 3%, obviously you pay for a fee, you do it. And, you know, new home sales exploded higher. And now when interest rates went up in 2022, refinancings fell off a cliff. Applications for new mortgages fell down. That's why people thought housing prices would collapse. They didn't, right, because people were trapped in. Obviously, you know this. Wouldn't you say that when interest rates collapse, it causes demand for loans to increase? And provided that people are willing to do the loans, it does. And also, like, if you have a Bank of America at 7% and it goes down to 3%, you just pay off your Bank of America and go someplace else. They're happy to do a 3% mortgage, right?
Well, it depends on the habit of the 3% mortgage. But to go back for a second, when interest rates collapsed after the global financial crisis, there was no lending whatsoever at any price. Balance sheets were bad. Household balance sheets were, both the lenders and the borrowers had bad balance sheets. Now you have a case where the balance sheets are good overall. So yeah, you get a lower rate, you want to lend. And there are sectors like cars and houses where interest rates matter a lot more, right? Like I said, it's not like they don't matter at all. But in the grand scheme of the economy, they matter a lot less. And you have to realize that interest rates might have collapsed, but if you go back a few years, they've been zero for a long, long time. So there weren't even all that many people to refinance. And part of the housing price, I think the bulk of the housing price problem, and this is why I was bullish home builders even before COVID, is the shortage of houses. Right, they're just not building enough houses out there. Now, it was exacerbated by COVID, but I would argue it was less about interest rates than more about people, get me out of the city, get me out of urban density. And that fad passed, and I'm happy to see people are going back to New York, right, and other places. But I think we over, again, getting back to the irrational, us tending to be less rational than we think we are, a lot of that got ascribed to QE and to monetary policy when these other factors, I think, were a lot more important. And you see that now because anytime, and we saw a little bit of this in 2023, and we're starting to see it again, when interest rates just stabilize, even at a higher level, demand starts to come back. Right. And there's some sticker shock. People have to get over it. Sure. You know, you're going to be more reluctant to get rid of your, to move if you've got a great interest rate. But after a while, you say, you know, that other opportunity somewhere else is better. Or, you know, you start, I need to buy the house because my wife is pregnant and we need to get out of the city. All those things start to happen. So I think when you really break it down, it ends up being, I'm not saying interest rates don't matter. And they certainly do in housing more than almost any other sector. It still matters less than these other factors. And we're going to see this again. That's why I'm still bullish home builders that kind of got out and got back in, because they have massive, they have demand on tap. And they have an extra advantage now with interest rates on the higher side and with people dealing with sticker shock, is that they can provide subsidies that the banks can't when they lend. All they have to do is increase the price of the house a little bit, right, and use that to fund, to buy down the rates on the loans. And people don't look at the final rate on that, that they're paying for the house. They look at the, what they're paying monthly and can they handle that. So it's kind of a sneaky way to if you want to call it that, to get buyers. So not only is there a housing shortage that we all know about, but the home builders now have a financing advantage with rates higher. If the rates are moving higher, it's not good for them. Then we all freeze up again. We go, oh no, what's happening here? Right? Because we don't like the movement. We don't like fast movement. That scares us. But when things stabilize, even at higher levels, that demand comes back. And it kind of belies that whole notion that it was all driven by interest rates. And you think about it, even QE, how much is that going to change the mortgage spread? It didn't change the mortgage spread dramatically. Even if people thought it was a safe asset for the rest of their existence, it's still not going to, I mean, right now, mortgage spreads are at 130 basis points. They might have been as tight as 90. 40 basis points isn't going to stop a guy with a pregnant wife from buying a house. So again, I'm not saying it doesn't matter. I'm saying because these things are rational and because they make sense in theory, we tend to overstate their power in reality.
I agree with you. 40 basis points is not going to make a change at all. But I am looking at the option adjusted spread for the S&P U.S. Mortgage-Backed Securities Index. And it did drastically compress from March 2020 to the middle of 2021. And then it inched higher.
So the question is, how many basis points? It's just not enough to really turn the dial for something. That's what I'm saying. Think about it. How many, when you're looking at your chart, how many basis points do you see from the low to the low to where we are now?
About 130 from peak to trough.
Well, I'm seeing 130 basis points right now.
So are you doing the 30-year mortgage?
I'm looking at the spread.
I'm looking at the option adjusted spread of the MBS index, and you're maybe doing the direct mortgage.
I'm just taking the par mortgage, and I'm subtracting the 5 year from it or something like that to get it. I don't know if it's apples to apples, but most people look at the mortgage spread and it's in the neighborhood of 130 basis points right now. What are you seeing?
So I have actually 40 basis points now, but for MBS. And if you're owning like a whole loan mortgage, I think you get a way better deal than if you put it like that. This is for MBS and yours, I think yours is for a direct mortgage. So like if you're a bank, you get way juicier yield. It doesn't matter. They are correlated, but I see your point that it's like the level of interest rates and the movement of the 10-year, the drastic up move we have, has mattered way more than quantitative easing. But you do grant that it does have an effect.
Yeah, oh, sure, but it's not so much the price or the yield matters. The spread, not so much. I think that gets lost in the yield movements, which are much larger. And the yield movements, we normalize to them. It's kind of like a sticker shock, and then we get over it. But I just don't think that, in part because we had that long period before where rates were really low, and a lot of people had, I know I've refinanced a couple few times in that period. Other people did too. There weren't, it's called convexity burnout in the mortgage market. When you've been up and down in that area so long that there are no mortgages left to refi when the rates go lower. Now, some people coming online had a chance to do that. It's true that everybody coming in had low rates, but not as much happened. A lot of it was already done. So, like I said, if we did not have the housing shortage and we didn't have that COVID shock, we wouldn't have had a lot of that. Got attributed to Fed policy, right? They just, people kind of said, oh, this makes sense. Prices go up, prices go down, people refinance. And let's be honest, there are a lot of people that kind of have an anti-Fed bias that need to tell a negative story. So they want to put it all on exogenous factors. But, you know, what always grounds me in these situations, Jack, because I stop and I start thinking about me and my friends and people I know and my friends' kids. What are they doing? Right. What are they actually doing? What are the steps that they go through to do these things? And I think when you do that, you realize it's more about having the pregnant wife or there being a housing shortage than it is about rates, except when the rates are moving fast, of course. And this is, mind you, this, we're talking about the sector where interest rates matter most because it's the most levered, right? So you can imagine for the other sectors, it just didn't turn the dial because the balance sheets were in good shape and people had jobs. That's kind of how I look at it. And fortunately, I said these things before all of this stuff happened, right? So it's not like I'm making up the story now. I spelled this out beforehand, how I thought it would go and why I thought it would go this way. And it's kind of played out. So monetary policy has a role to play, but it's just a much less powerful instrument, particularly in the globalized financial world with all kinds of shadow banking that we live in today. And of course, initial conditions are everything. And people just kind of skirted over that. They looked, oh, the last three recessions, this happened. So therefore, right, there was kind of that thinking without really examining difference. And listen, I've been in markets a long time. That's what tends to happen. In the first instance, we draw the fossil parallel, right? There's just a simple kind of brain dead parallel. Oh, this looks roughly like this. And then as we go forward in time, we start to see the differences. And over the past year, I would say, we started to see the differences with respect to initial conditions much better than we did before.
In 2017, Forward Guidance's exclusive sponsor, VanEck, was the first ETF issuer to file for a Bitcoin-linked ETF. 7 years later, Bitcoin ETFs are finally available. Using the VanEck Bitcoin Trust ticker HODL, you can invest in Bitcoin with zero fees until March 31st, 2025. That's right, zero fees until March 31st, 2025. Search the ticker HODL in your brokerage app today or visit vaneck.com/HODLFG to learn more. Now, the disclosures. An investment in the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, also known as the Trust or HODL, involves significant risk and may not be suitable for all investors. You could lose your entire investment. The Trust offers fewer investor protections as it is not registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940 or as a commodity pool under the Commodity Exchange Act. For a complete discussion of the risk factors relative to the Trust, carefully read the prospectus link below. You can learn more about HODL and its zero fees until March 31st, 2025 at vaneck.com/HODLFG. That's vaneck.com/HODLFG. And now back to the interview. What would you say right now to the people who say that the stock market is going up because the Federal Reserve is doing shadow quantitative easing by draining the reverse repo facility?
I say they need subscribers, right? I think it's bullshit to use the French word. First of all, you remember it was the bank term funding program. Oh, look, they're doing QE. Look, that's why the stock market is going up, right? That got repaid. Stock market stayed higher. Look at TGA. They're drawing down the TGA.
Treasury General account, yeah. The U.S. government's account. Yeah.
Right, which resides at the Fed and takes away from the fixed pool of reserves, right? Or takes away or adds to. So that got totally replenished. Nothing happened. Now they're saying, oh, well, look, it's the reversed repo that's getting drawn down. Well, yeah, reversed repo is excess reserves. So they weren't going into the stock market anyway. And I didn't hear anybody making the argument when the reserve repo was increasing that, oh, this isn't pumping up the stock market because it's just going right into reserves. They're saying, no, it's pumping up the stock market and it's artificial. So the people that you're hearing arguing this basically, that no, it's just reserve repo, these guys, none of them, I guarantee you, were making the argument when reserve repo was getting filled that it didn't matter for risk assets because it was going in. They only discovered it now. But that's exactly why QE doesn't matter. It just goes into excess reserves and then comes out of excess reserves. And the government is just giving you one liability in exchange for another in your fixed income portfolio. That's not going to make you go out and change your allocation between fixed income and stocks, right? If you, instead of holding a T-bill, you hold a government deposit with roughly the same interest rate, just to make it simple, right? You still got your 60-40. You're not going to change it to 70-30 because of that, right? So that's all that's happening. This money stays there. Now, it may well be for another reason that you want to go to 70-30, right? Because you see everyone buying coins and you want to participate or whatever, you know, whatever the risk capital asset and Nvidia, right? A legitimate company, a great company. It goes up. People want to get, you know, want to get involved. Those kinds of things can make people change their allocation from 60-40 to 70-30, but not the treasury or the Fed buying you know, buying your T-bills and giving you deposits. Now, if they're buying your bonds, maybe you have a duration shortfall that you need for your book reasons. But those people aren't buying stocks anyway. These are banks, right? So they might buy some mortgages or they might buy some high grade if they need to replace their duration. But if they really wanted to take risk and, you know, people wanted to increase their allocation to stocks, they could have, they didn't have to wait for QE. They could have sold their bonds beforehand and just and bought the stock. So it's just a, if you get back and you think about how people behave, what drives our decisions, right? It's not this. And to go take it a step further, as we know, with QE 1, 2, and 3, we saw those. When those happened, yields were going higher, not lower. Why? Because the placebo effect changed economic expectations in a way that people didn't want to hold bonds. So it's the argument that, oh, well, QE drives down interest rates, and therefore it's going to increase the desire to buy equities. That doesn't really work, because that wasn't happening. Right. At least not in a
not in an observable way. Definitely. All periods of most periods of quantitative easing happened as interest rates, long term interest rates rose, not fell. And if the Federal Reserve is buying trillions of it, they should go down. Right. But here, Mark, is such an important point. I'm glad you brought this up, about how do you determine what is a cause and what is an effect? In other words, going back to our conversation, you said that because monetary conditions can get, you know, moderately tighter while the stock market goes up, therefore, monetary conditions don't matter. What if it is that the reason the Federal Reserve had to raise interest rates was because the economy was too hot and the stock market was too hot, and that what caused the interest rates to go up is that they were too loose, and therefore it's the effect, not the cause.
We just don't have a lot of examples of that really happening. It conforms with the theory, and that's why it resonates with people's intuition so powerfully. But like I said, we just don't see that happening. Look, the Fed raised 500 basis points and has done a yard and a half of QT. The long end has only gone up 300 basis points. It hasn't gone up by more than 500. It's gone up by less, right? So I'm saying the effects might be there, but they're so small that we can't say even if they're there. They're not discernible. What's discernible is the yield curve going up and down in response to people's economic expectations, right? Growth and inflation and all that typical stuff, but not the supply argument that people make. We just don't see that. It just doesn't matter. All the people predicting the QE was going to do these things, now they're coming up with excuses, in part because they've been wrong, and in part because it allows them to defend their worldview. Their worldview is that every policy move is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally agree.
Right? And there are a lot of guys out there now, and it sells really well. And we know the behavioral reason for that. Man is a hierarchical being, and it makes us feel better to crap on other people, right? I mean, that's just kind of how humans work. So to talk about whether it's high school cafeteria food or the principal or whatever authority figure you want to say, these guys are idiots, this is what they should be doing, that always sells because it makes us feel better about ourselves. It makes us feel less impotent and less insignificant. And it's kind of getting deep on the psychology side, but I've been around a long time and I see how it works, and I see the personalities of the people arguing these things. So it just, like I said, people are kind of scrapping around for arguments to avoid saying, oh, you know, QE actually doesn't do anything and QT doesn't do much either. I mean, I'm not saying that they don't do anything. I know I get misquoted there, but they do very, very little, so small that you can't even tell if it is anything, right? They're indistinguishable from zero, just because you can't. The other effects are just swamping it, right? So this is the problem. You don't see it in term premium. Multiples have expanded under QT. They've expanded under higher rates. So all of the theoretical things that make such compelling intuitive sense didn't happen, right? And it's not as if they're going to end up at the end of repo and everything is going to crash. I remember my days as a mutual fund a fixed income manager. I managed mostly emerging market portfolios, but I also managed the TIPS portfolio and a credit portfolio, a couple of other things. And I got to know some of the analysts. And I noticed in the high yield desk in particular, the high grade desk, excuse me, the high yield desk, they did their work pretty well. But the high grade guys spent most of their time simulating golf swings, right? They were just kind of hanging around. And then when an issuance would come, when supply would come, spreads tightened. They didn't loosen. And this, for me, was a phenomenon. Why? How would spreads tighten when they're increasing supply? it's because it catalyzed interest in the sector, got the guys to stop simulating their golf swings and focus on their business. And they said, hey, that actually looks good. And then they heard the sell side pitches and it sounded even better. And pretty soon that effect swamped any supply effect. So that was my first clue that how easy it is to swamp these kinds of supply effects like we're talking about with QE and QT. I mean, I just don't know how else you explain it. Like I said, the TGA story went away. We know they replenished it, and then people stopped talking about it. The bank term funding program, they repaid all of that, and people stopped talking about it. Now they're onto something else. And they're going to talk about, you know, I mean, to think that changing $50 billion in issuance from the Treasury from one part of the curve to another is going to provoke a huge response is just laughable. It's much more important what we think is happening to inflation and growth. That's what drives the bond market, and this other stuff gets lost. So it's I'm glad I had this conviction. It was a huge moneymaker for me. And to be honest, for most of my career, fading other people's fear of the Fed, all these stories that come out, has been a huge money winner, has been a huge trade, right? And I don't see that stopping anytime soon, in part because of people's needs. A lot of guys need clicks, they need boogeymen, and a lot of guys have the ideology, I call them the policy bears, that all policy moves are always, you know, always wrong. The Fed is always screwed up. I posted something kind of joke, you know, tongue in cheek this morning, how it was only 12 months ago that people were screaming on television about the Fed doesn't cut now, a recession is a lock. And now there are people starting to berate the Fed for signaling cuts. You know, and the Venn diagram probably overlaps a lot between these two groups, right? They need to criticize the Fed because it makes them feel better, makes their clients feel better. They get more clicks or more subscriptions. It validates their worldview, all those kinds of things. But in the real world, where those of us who manage money live, it just doesn't work.
Right. And I think that if you go from saying the Federal Reserve is making a mistake by being too tight to now it's making the mistake of being too loose, somewhere along the line, you should reach the middle zone of actually saying, I agree with Federal Reserve policy. I think it's right.
Exactly. It doesn't happen too often. And I'm not saying the Fed always gets everything right or gets everything wrong. I understand where they're coming from a lot better, I think, than other people from my policy experience, right? I worked at the Treasury Department for a couple different presidents. I, you know, worked total for three different presidents. I've got a lot of policy experience at the International Monetary Fund. I climbed into so many central banks around the world, I can't even tell you. So you get to understand how the plumbing works. And it just it was an eye opener for me because I studied in graduate school. We didn't have behavioral finance or behavioral economics yet. So I was always a little bit skeptical of efficient markets, just knowing how humans behave. And then I saw reality. I go, wow, this is not even close to rational, you know, because, you know, we have meme coins and all kinds of crazy things happen regularly, right, in different forms. So it's been a huge boon to me over my career. But, you know, it's kind of too bad that it undermines the trust in the Fed. And they've done not a perfect job, but they've done, I think, a really good job, all things considered. And I even understand where they were coming from by being late to hike, right? I totally get that. That made sense to me. Wait until the absolute last minute for inflation to correct on its own because the nature of the shock was transitory. But we kept getting shocks. And at some point when you feel, so you wait for the, you know, we didn't know how many shocks there were going to be. We got the Delta wave and that changed. That was a game changer. And that, I think that opened the Fed's eyes and other guys' eyes. And they said, oh, Jesus, now we have to worry about whether or not if it's just one shock, we know it's going to settle down on its own and we're going to be okay. Two shocks. Now, all of a sudden, you get the boats. I saw them out, you know, off my balcony here, lining up the coast and to get into the port at Long Beach, right? And there's nothing the Fed could have done about that. But it got to a point where they were afraid that long-term expectations were going to be unanchored. And then they said, okay, we're going to wait until that moment, and then we're going to go hard. And that's what they did. Now, in my mind's eye, they should have begun QT sooner because we had a mini asset bubble in certain, you know, in coins and SPACs and a few other things. And there's a signaling effect from that, kind of the reverse of the placebo effect. So many people believe that was pumping up the market, even though it wasn't. That taking it away was probably enough for people to stop and say, like I was saying earlier, if you're really out over your skis taking risk, any little change can trigger you retrenching. And then once that starts, it feeds on itself and the bubble corrects. So that might have helped. But to be honest, Jack, I'm a guy who tends to think that, you know, what I take the under with respect to the effect of monetary policy on the economy and on markets. I take the under with respect to the wealth effect as well. And I was still surprised that the wealth effect in 2022 was as weak as it was. Even I, the guy who always takes the under, expected, I expected a bigger hit to growth from that. I didn't expect a recession, but I thought we were going to slow down more. And I think one of the reasons why people, I mean, obviously the yield curve and people who focus on the money supply, I think that's entirely intellectually wrong. But I understand that a lot of people focus on it because traditionally that's what people did. We talked about why the world is, the monetary world is different, is different today. But what surprised me, I think what led a lot of people to think that the risk of recession was much, much higher and indeed imminent was the sectoral reallocations we were getting as a result of the COVID shock. So COVID basically shut down services, right? So as we know, incomes were maintained and it all went into goods. We couldn't go to the go to restaurants. We couldn't travel. We couldn't, you know, go to the movies, whatever it is. We couldn't do those things. So we had a big surge in manufacturing and there was a backlog. And then because supply of that got curtailed too. And then everyone scrambled to ramp up their production of goods. And we all of a sudden we had an inventory glut, right? So as services were coming back, we were developing an inventory glut on the goods side. So these just massive sectoral swings. Now, our statistical system is geared towards the old economy we used to have that was much more manufacturing heavy. So people were looking at the indicators coming across the transom and they were saying, you know, oh, and they were overstating them. I'm not saying they were wrong. They were wrong, but they understandable that they say, oh, the probability of recession is increasing. But they were getting carried away with what the absolute level of probability was because they were missing the point that this was only capturing one part of the economy and it was overweighted in its representation given the, you know, archaic statistical system that we live under. So, you know, I get that whole process, but I think that explains a lot of what was happening with the Fed and what was happening with, you know, people expecting a recession. And I should say, though, we should learn the other thing. You know, I was saying earlier that, you know, the takeaway from this is the importance of initial conditions in monetary policy. That's one takeaway. The other takeaway I think that people should have is you can't stop a shock. You can't stop. A central bank can't stop all forms of inflation. If the shock is the wrong kind of shock, you're going to get inflation no matter what the central bank does. What can the central bank do, though? Keep long-term inflation expectations in check. Let people know that you're on it. And as soon as you work through these transitory problems or whatever name you want to put on them, right? You know, these short-term issues that are causing inflation, in this case, the supply side falling apart, once we put that back together, your inflation is going to be low again. And if you look at the longer term inflation expectations in the markets, they never got that high. So for me, that's how you should judge a central bank's job, not whether or not there was inflation. We can't pretend that they could stop COVID, right? But their job was to make sure, given that shock or those shocks, right? And in those shocks, the Russian invasion came at the worst possible time. Right when the Fed started to worry in November of 2021 about expectations being unanchored, a couple months later, we got that shock. And we didn't know how long it was going to last. Fortunately, because the SPR drawdown and other production increases, it didn't last that long. But we didn't know that at the time, and it happened at the worst possible time. And so the Fed had to go hard to keep these longer-term expectations in check. And I think in that respect, they did a good job. And I understand, I know they're heavily criticized for starting 3 months later, however many months late, but it wasn't going to fix, you know, starting 3 months earlier wasn't going to fix the ports in Long Beach. It wasn't going to stop the Delta wave. So I just don't think it mattered that much. And if you take it further mathematically, right, I do think fiscal contributed to the inflation for sure. I don't think monetary did. I think the fiscal did to some degree, but even there, you know, I always think of long-term income growth as kind of a line that gently slopes upwards, right? When you get one of these shocks, it's like you have a big U, a big dent in that line, a big downward dent. And fiscal policy is designed to fill that hole. Now, we can argue whether or not they overfilled the hole, which they probably did a little bit this time, or they underfilled the hole, which they probably did in the GFC,
right?
But they're filling a hole. So at the margin, yeah, it created more inflation. And obviously would have had a lot less inflation if they had let unemployment stay at 10% and everything fall apart. But that's not a, that's a non-starter in a democratic system. So you have to say, how much damage might that have done? And then, okay, so we had in 2022, yeah, so we had 3 years of inflation, 4%, 8%, and 3%, right? That's kind of where we've been coming out. We'll see where we come out this year, maybe 3% again. But let's just, to make it simple.
So 2021, 4%, 2022, 8%, 2023, 3%.
Yeah, 3.5 or something like that, whatever. Yeah. Some 3 and change. Okay, so we know that target inflation is 2%, right? That's the tolerated amount of inflation. So for 3 years, that gives you 6% cumulative of target. Now, before we go any further, you have to ask yourself, how much do you think intuitively fiscal policy added to inflation? It was responsible for that inflation. Is it 50%? Is it 75%? Is it 25%? Pick a number. What do you think?
I'll just throw out 60%. Not that I have confidence in that number, but yeah.
So you say 60% caused by fiscal. I think that's on the high side, but let's take it. Okay. So if you have cumulative target of 6, and then you have 4, 8, and 3, right? That's 15, right? So 6 from 15 is 9. Okay. If you think not from that 9, you think 60% of that was caused by fiscal, you only get an extra 2% a year. That's what it was. If that's the price for maintaining income and unemployment, I think that's high. I think most of the estimates are coming in closer to 30, right? But whatever, it doesn't matter. The math works for anything. It just shows you it's kind of a small price to pay to overfill that hole a little bit relative to underfill that hole, which took us, you know, all those years to, you know, took much longer to get back on trend.
So the math went a little bit over my head. I'm sure when, you know,
I went fast.
We look back at it. I'll get it, and our audience will get that. We'll understand it.
But it's worth spelling out because it's an important point. So if it's 2% is your target,
yeah,
and you have 3 years of that.
So that's okay. That's 6, and then 4, 8, and 3. That's 15 divided by 3 is 5.
Yes. So you have 3%. That's another way of looking at it. 3% of excess inflation per year. That's what we had. Now, you're saying 2/3 of that roughly was because of fiscal. Roughly. I think it's more like 1/3. Either way, you're talking between 1% and 2% extra a year in exchange for the best economy of all the G7 economies, right? So they might have overfilled the hole, but in the grand scheme of things, it wasn't that much. Of course, it feels like a lot more when you're paying more for things and you have to buy eggs when the eggs are surging, or you have to buy gas when gas is surging. But in the grand scheme of things, it's just not that much. So I like I said, I think all things considered, there's criticism here and there, but things went really, really, really well, and they could have gone a lot worse.
I happen to agree with you, but you know that people are either going to agree with what you said or not, and it's a very ideological point, right?
But it's only ideological on the people who aren't looking at the evidence. Because if you're looking at the evidence, I mean, what the math, those are numbers I gave you. It wasn't an opinion. Now, the opinion was whether you think it's 2/3 or I think it's 1/3.
No, but Mark, the opinion of was the chance of averting a recovery, again, the probability of which, you know, we don't know whether, you know, how bad it could have been. Obviously, it could have been greater than the Great Depression, or it could have been a mild recession.
But we know. I mean, 10% unemployment.
If they hadn't
provided the income, if they hadn't provided the income and to get people back to a low level of unemployment, we would have had hysteresis. This is the problem. We would have had that problem when because think about it. If you have a shock, you have a supply and you have some demand, right? And you have a shock like this, and both of them fall. So public policy supports demand, but supply is really low, right? Mm. But with public demand high, that gives an incentive for supply to get back up to that demand as fast as possible. If, however, both of them take a shock and you do nothing with demand, people don't have any incentive to build back supply. And as you know, the whole hysteresis thesis, that capital lies fallow and pretty much goes to waste at some point. It starts to deteriorate and over time, and your ability to get the supply back to where it was before diminishes, right? It keeps the supply alive in a certain sense. So this is the reason why when there's a hole and you get a shock, you need fiscal policy so that the supply side has an incentive to come back and doesn't wither away, right? And I think this is why when you look at the U.S. compared to the countries that we see, other industrialized countries, if you want to call them that, why we've done better, because they allowed for more atrophy of the supply side rather than the supply side rushing to come back to meet demand.
Mark, what I was saying is that it is inherently up to people's judgment what percentage inflation was like worth that risk. You know, some people would say, you know, they could deal with a 5% inflation because it could have been such a Great Depression. Other people would say, actually, I like the free market economy and we made distortions that are socialist, blah, 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 blah. It is a matter of opinion.
But that's ideological. So that's the ideological part. The ideological part is not like both sides are ideological. Just looking at the facts, I mean, no one likes bigger government. No one likes to pay taxes. No one likes it any of these things. No one ever roots for government. But if you sit back and objectively and say, did it work? It worked, unless you have some kind of ideology where you're saying, well, it would have been better with a free market. There's absolutely no evidence of that, and a lot of evidence that it wouldn't have been. And in fact, the GFC was a light version of that, right? We didn't spend enough fiscally to get us back up the curve fast enough. So we have a lot of evidence. And if you look around the world, there's even more evidence of this. We don't look around the world a lot. And then, you know, 5% inflation, you could talk about how much inflation is tolerable. But you and I, in our two scenarios, and I think your scenario is pretty extreme, now, you know, the 60%, or it's on the high side for sure. Both of those, you're talking about 1 or 2% extra a year. It's not like we're talking about 5 or 10% extra a year. That would be a different story, right? Because you start to get numbers like that, and then it runs a lot more risk of getting entrenched in the system. So when you actually break down the numbers, it wasn't that bad. It's just ideologically, people don't like government involved. People think they have this kind of notion free markets have to clear in a certain way, and we know markets don't work. I mean, we know markets are better than anything else, but we know they fail.
Yes.
It's a little bit like what they say about the U.S. is that they'll do all the wrong, they'll do the right thing after exhausting all the bad options. Well, capitalism is the least bad option, right? It's not perfect. It's just better than everything else. Right?
Mark, I've got a question. So the Treasury issued a bunch of Treasury debt in March to fund these, you know, very extreme fiscal programs to meet the extreme shock in the economy. And the Federal Reserve bought a lot of that debt, or even if it wasn't the same debt, they bought.
I don't know when the issuance started. I would have to look and see when the issuance started. I know what happened was, I know for sure what happened. We'd have to look at the fiscal. You may be right. I don't think you are, because I don't think fiscal mobilizes that quickly. But nonetheless, we had a huge supply of treasuries from people wanting cash.
Yes.
Because and so this is that monetary elasticity that the system needs to provide. Because think about it. If you're holding a bond or you're holding a deposit at the Fed, they're both claims on the government. So you have a preference. I like the bond because it yields more. But the cash, I have immediate access to that if I need it for settlements, right? So in stress, what do people do? They sell their bonds and they buy cash because they don't know how much cash they're going to need in the cash register, right? That's like a shop owner. Could be a big weekend. I need to stock up on cash. Doesn't mean the business is going to come, but it's there. At the same time, you had a lot of hedge funds in basis trades.
Yes.
That made it even worse, so that exacerbated that problem. So you got selling because people, you know, under times of stress, people sell bonds and buy cash because of that liquidity preference, right? This was exacerbated by that push triggering stops on a lot of these trades. So that's what happened. Now the Fed comes in and says, okay, we need a circuit breaker because people are starting to panic. Because, you know, if you own a stock that goes down 50% in a week, you're going to panic. And you're more likely to sell than if it goes down 50% over the course of a year. You bleed to death and you're more willing to put up with it, right? Same kind of thing there. The Fed comes in to short circuit the panic, provide the cash liquidity, and so that the market can settle down and trade. Why? Because markets fail. They don't fail often, but they can fail badly. And treasuries are at the center of the global financial system. And you don't want the risk of a cascading defaults of people having to unwind positions all over the world. So you step in, you say, okay, I understand there's a big shock here, and there's an unusual demand for liquidity, for settlement liquidity. I'm going to provide that. And they did. And things calmed down. People could trade rationally, and we go back to looking at our other factors. To suggest that we should have let the free market clear means you know nothing about policy and you have no real life experience. There's just no way anyone with real life experience could want that to happen. I mean, I've seen it in too many countries. When people panic, they panic, and the panic feeds on itself. Having something that can short circuit that panic is hugely advantageous.
Yes, and so I'm looking at the TGA, and it started exploding higher April 1st through July 22nd. And then the CARES Act was signed on March 27th. Stock market bottom was March 23rd. And then I think the extreme QE was around mid to late March, I believe. I don't know the exact dates.
Yeah, basically when the selling got intense late in the third week of March, the fiscal stuff comes later, but it sounded like it came pretty soon. But it kind of doesn't change the story. If you're suggesting that the treasury market would have exploded if the Fed hadn't, you know, monetized the deficit kind of thing, which you'll hear a lot of guys argue, fine. But the bigger thing was there was a huge demand for cash, right? I mean, now we've seen it. We've settled down and there's no yields aren't exploding and the treasury's issuing all kinds of amounts. So why would it be desirable to let the treasury market explode? I just don't see any circumstances. Now, you don't want the Fed to be in. I prefer the Fed to have as small a balance sheet as possible, right? Obviously, they've changed regime. They've gone to a floor regime, so they're going to need a lot more reserves than they needed before. That's a separate and interesting discussion. But you don't want to let the center of the global financial system dysfunction just fall into to dysfunction. You need the bid and the ask to clear. And it's an unfortunate system in some respects, because in the run to the GFC is kind of when we had peak treasury liquidity, because just the way the capital charges were done, banks could allocate more capital to market making than they do now. And there are more hedge funds involved in market making in the treasury market than used to be the case. And that makes the market more brittle than it otherwise needs to be. That can be fixed through structural reform, and it should be. But it's still, if the market is failing, you need to step in, or there are collateral effects on innocent people that haven't done anything wrong.
You said, yeah, the treasury market was breaking in March of 2020, but not the bill. It was the 10-year, the 5-year, the coupon part of the market. And that broke before the flood of issuance. So I just want to get that thing. But the treasury market was breaking, and the Federal Reserve did bail the treasury market out then in, you know, March of 2020.
They stepped in and bought, they stepped in and provided liquidity when, as I was saying, a lot of the hedge fund guys, the treasury dealers, they kind of have, they're usually associated with banks, and they have an obligation to kind of be good citizens in the market, and they'll get brownie points for other parts of the regulatory regime kind of thing. Hedge funds don't have that constraint, so they can just ghost you. They can just disappear if something happens. So it's a structural flaw that should be addressed. Unfortunately, it's just so wonky and geeky that no one's ever going to pay attention to it. But I think our treasury system can be made robust. But what I do know is if the treasury hadn't stepped in and provided liquidity, more people would have been hurt that didn't deserve to be hurt. Now, it's sad because the hedge fund's taking a bad bet. They deserve to get hurt, right? Guys deserving to taking risk, like in the GFC, mm-hmm. all those banks deserve to go bankrupt.
Yes.
But in doing that, you would have dragged down so many innocent people that didn't do anything wrong. The guy, you know, the dry cleaner in Cedar Rapids who has a chain of four dry cleaners, and he's got deposits that on-lend the deposits to Citigroup, he wouldn't have been able to make payroll, right? Unless the government steps in and short-circuit that. So it's not fair in the sense that some people who deserve to go bankrupt for the risks they took don't go bankrupt. But, you know, it's a little bit like that train switch thing. You know, do you save a bunch of people, or do you let that one guy who deserves to die, die?
So the Federal Reserve bailed out treasury market in March.
I wouldn't use the word bail it out, because I think they just provided liquidity so that the market could start to clear on its own. And it took a while because they had to absorb a lot of the selling, the forced selling that was going on. But their mindset is not to bail out anybody. Their mindset is to ensure that the markets can work, that they can work, and they can work out the price issues, that there are there's no market failure where supply and demand don't meet.
Yeah. So the word bailout is has some connotation that you don't agree with, but it sounds like we agree on the facts. And also I'll say, you said add liquidity. We know it's not lender of last resort, it's dealer of last resort. Like, it's not that they were lending against them. It was just buying one way flow. But the way I'm saying, what do you think about, Mark, the narrative that U.S. Treasury debt is increasing, the government is increasing its debt, which is true on an absolute basis. It's also especially true on a debt to GDP basis. As such, you know, debt to GDP, which was, I'm just looking at 40% in the 70s, and now it's 120 percent. It's marginally down from 2020, but it's still very, you know, high relative to historical basis, that the Federal Reserve has to monetize that debt to inflate away the debt so that, you know, there's no natural buyers for treasuries because there's too much of them. And that the, you know, the Federal Reserve has to inflate away the debt by keeping interest rates lower than the rate of inflation as it did in World War II, the 1940s. What do you think about that?
Well, the first thing is not happening, right? People are buying treasuries and the policy rate is higher than inflation. So that's the first thing. So they're not doing it. Second is I heard all these arguments in 2008. I remember there was a guy who came into our hedge fund and he was a large family office and he was thinking about allocating to our fund. And he said, they've got to inflate away the debt. There's going to be and that's what they're doing. There's massive inflation. It's coming because look at all the money they're printing, right? And I said, there's not going to be inflation. And he kind of went, what? And I said, and besides, the Treasury is issuing a bunch of tips to signal that they're not trying to inflate away the debt. But that person didn't notice that. And they went back, you know, they went back and they didn't invest with us. And they told my boss to go, Mark's a real smart guy, but my God, he's going to be wrong on inflation. Right? Why? Getting back to what I was saying before, Japan has a much higher debt ratio than we do, and they don't have any problems. We're the center of the universe, and we just don't have any problems issuing our debt. It just hasn't been a problem. A lot of people have said, well, if the Fed weren't intervening, yields would be a lot higher. Well, now we see the Fed not intervening, and the yields are not a lot higher. So I just don't buy the story. I've heard it before, and I'm sure other people have heard it in previous crises. There was a cover of Time magazine from 1973 saying, "Is America broke?" Because our debt to GDP ratio got to a certain level. So people have been saying that forever. We do have an exorbitant privilege in that we are the reserve currency for the rest of the world. And even if people want to diversify away from us, and many of them do, they can't. They can't do it. What's the alternative? The reason gold is going up is not because of inflation, or it's not because of the debt, all the things that the gold bugs always repeat every time. We saw this in 2009. Yields were going up and gold was going up, and they said it must be they're afraid of the debt. They must be afraid of inflation because they're printing money. None of that happened. What's happening now, what changed, and we saw this in the correlation between rates and gold in the run-up to the Russian invasion. Usually, and not always, gold trades on a few different things, but dominantly, very strongly, it trades on real rates and to a lesser extent on nominal rates, right? There are points in time when it'll correlate to the dollar or to other things, but by and large, day in, day out, it correlates to real rates. That broke down a few months ahead of, I'm going to say 4, 5, 6 months ahead of the Russian invasion. Why? Russia wanted to diversify to the extent they could. Now, they couldn't do much, right? Because the dollar market is massive and the gold market is small. But they invaded and they got their sanctions and all the other countries kind of said, oh, no. They could weaponize the dollar against us. So you had a lot of state and non-state actors who were all of a sudden saying, at least at the margin, I should try and diversify. And they've been diversifying. And a small flow out of the dollar market into a much smaller gold market makes it go up. And that's what's been driving. I don't know when that goes away or if that goes away. Now we're at the stage where momentum players and other people with their narratives about unsustainable debt and inflation coming back, they're entering the chat, as it were. But the genesis of this and the breakdown of the correlation started then. But again, like these other things, this is a phenomenon I've seen before, at least the one about people ascribing the gold going up to too much debt, expansive fiscal policy, and coming inflation. And that's not it this time either. It's really about fear of weaponization of the dollar. And proof, as it were, that it's not hurting the dollar is because against all the currencies, dollar's not doing badly whatsoever. It's doing fine against other currencies. It's only a little bit of money going out of the dollar market into the gold market makes the gold market go up a lot.
Yeah, and actually, gold is going up recently, but over the past 3 years, it's definitely struggled in dollar terms. But if you look at it, chart of gold in Japanese yen terms, it just looks like the most bullish chart ever. So you're saying that gold, quote unquote, should have gone down, or basically because the real rates exploded higher from very negative to positive in 2022, let's say, gold, which normally trades on real rates, ought to have gone down, but it didn't go down by as nearly as much because of there's that bid for away from the dollar.
It didn't even go down. The correlation broke, basically.
Yeah.
The correlation broke. So, and it's been going up. And then the chart recently got good and had a breakout, and all the chart monkeys got excited, chart monkeys like me. We got excited and said, okay, gold's going to move. And I'd recognize, though, that that this, because I follow gold closely, and I recognize that the correlation had broken down a long time ago, and this weaponization of the dollar is a real fear. And it looks fine against the dollar, too. In dollar terms, gold looks okay, too, these days, over the past 2 years or something like that. But again, I think it's this phenomenon. Normally, when real rates go up, people say, oh, well, I can get 5% in T-bills, or I can get nothing in Iraq. Right. And the rock goes down. But that's not happening. So but because it's going up, we get back to the post hoc ergo propter hoc phenomenon. People saying, oh, it's going up and the debt is going up. And maybe we're talking about inflation again, even though we weren't recently. People saying, oh, it must be that, because in their minds, in their ideological framework, that's what drives gold. But we've seen this in previous cycles when this has happened, and it hasn't drive gold. The new feature is the fear of the weaponization of the dollar and the massive discrepancy between the size of the dollar market and the size of the gold market.
Okay, but doesn't that validate, or in other words, wouldn't you agree then with the core thesis of many gold bugs, if I'm allowed to use that phrase, that people don't want the dollar and people want gold? I mean, on your Twitter, it says you're a fiat enthusiast.
It wouldn't, or dollar, the dollar would be going down against other things. That's what I'm saying. So I think people would want to diversify out of gold to a greater, out of dollars to a greater degree, but they can't. Mm-hmm. There's no alternative. There was a great, I hope you forgive me for mentioning another podcast here, but Odd Lots with Brad Setzer. He talks a lot about, Brad and I have a common history. We had the same job at the Treasury for a bit, and kind of, he went on at some length about just the dollar dominance and fading, increasing, why, et cetera. And he goes through a lot of these things, I think, and lays them out really well, looking at the stats, just not spouting from memory as I am. It's worth a listen. It's just really, really hard to diversify away from the dollar. It's so entrenched in the global system, and the masses is so large.
Yeah, I love Brad, love Odd Lots, and I really like how he's brought up, I learned from him how China basically buys a lot of their treasuries through Belgium. So their official treasury account looks like they're dumping treasuries, but they're actually not by as much, if you include blood.
Yes, exactly. So Brad and I, we're both kind of forensic economists on balance of payments issues on countries around the world. We were kind of like the treasury guys that were sent to figure out the balance of payments of countries in trouble, that we were kind of like hitmen in that regard. Brad stuck with it. I took a wrong turn and ended up managing money. But that's the kind of stuff we used to do. Brad does an amazing job at that.
So, Marcus, people can say, as much as you kind of downplay the importance of plumbing, or say it's less important than some people say, which.
No, plumbing is important. So I should make this distinction, Jack, because it's really important, because I kind of say things very forcefully, and it's easy to think I don't think monetary policy matters at all or whatever. But there's an important distinction between QE or balance sheet size or monetary policy for the plumbing and monetary policy for economic stimulus.
Yeah,
I think with the benefit of hindsight, it works great for the plumbing. It provides that, the dealer system is imperfect and all these other kinds of things, but it provides the elasticity for the monetary system that we need for it to function so that settlements can take place in orderly fashion. For economic stimulus, I think we have enough evidence now to look back and say it really wasn't very forceful. It wasn't forceful for markets, or we wouldn't be at all-time highs. It wasn't forceful for the economy, because we've just seen it. We saw it in the previous cycle, and we've seen it in this cycle. This cycle, it's easy to conflate with the fiscal and other factors that were positive and think it was monetary. But if you go back and compare to the GFC, when it was all monetary and much less fiscal, we didn't do so well. We didn't recover. I mean, we did okay, but we recovered very slowly because, like I said, you can lead a banker to liquidity, but you can't make them lend.
Do you also think that in the great financial crisis, there were pipes over which the Federal Reserve did not have control, like asset-backed commercial paper market or something like a CDO market or the LIBOR market, the Eurodollar market, whereas now much more of that because of the size of the Fed's balance sheet, but also because of SOFR has replaced LIBOR and a handful of other reasons.
Yes, I do. I agree with you. I don't think it's the size of the Fed balance sheet. I think it's they were surprised by a lot of the plumbing issues that a lot of the governors probably weren't fully aware of even. They just kind of assumed that the plumbing worked, right? And they had to learn this on the fly, and so they're a little slower to respond. When COVID happened and that shock happened, they knew what to look for. They had a much, so it's more the facilities that were willing to roll out, the swaps that they do with overseas banks to provide, because they have systems through their shadow banking systems, they're creating dollars too, right? And sometimes they have a liquidity squeeze. So I think it's the facilities that they rolled out and the sense of awareness from having lived through the GFC that got them on top of this much more rapidly. And now anytime, philosophically, and I think people mistake this a lot, what they care about is that the markets function, that they clear. They're not trying to pump anything up or pump anything down. I know there are wealth effects and things like that, but their thought is if we take care of the economy and make sure we minimize collateral damage and structural damage, when the economy recovers, stocks will go up and maybe there'll be a wealth effect from that and that will be a bonus. But we need to make sure that the economy is functioning. So I really think it's not about the size of the balance sheet. It's about the facilities that, you know, they've understood these markets much better and they're ready for market failure to a degree they weren't last time. I think that's the big difference. The big difference with the balance sheet, there's a great, I'm going to do this again, I'm sorry, another podcast, David Beckworth.
Oh, yeah.
Musings.
That one's
right?
Great.
It's I'm sure you love it. It's for geeks, monetary guys, guys who like monetary stuff. I love it. He did one with Bill Nelson recently, who used to work at the Fed, ran the discount window. And they talk about how, obviously, in a floor system, you need a lot more reserves. Okay, you need a lot more reserves. But the amount of reserves for their high quality liquid assets, but you know, banks can hold either reserves or bonds. They can choose. And that preference is influenced by their past. So if they live through a crisis, right, they're going to be much less, much more reluctant to put too much into bonds. Because as I was saying earlier, bonds settle T plus one. So if you get a settlement rush, you might not be able to meet your settlements if you've got to liquidate bonds. Whereas if you have Fed funds, you can meet that immediately. So there are a lot of regulatory things and incentive things that can be done to reduce the amount of reserves that banks need to hold. But they need to hold a lot more than used to be the case under a floor system. So, you know, you'll see a lot of guys, well, oh yeah, of course QT hasn't worked. They've got 6 billion left or 5 billion left or whatever the number is. They're not going back. And that number didn't get pumped into the market anyway. And they're certainly not going back to the number. It's sitting there in the cash register for transactions, right, in case they're needed. So I think it's just kind of a fundamental misconception of how these things actually work.
Right. But when the Federal Reserve does quantitative easing, it issues reserves and it buys bonds from primary dealers, the banks then don't have those bonds. Don't they have to then buy bonds back to replenish their assets?
If they have a duration goal, they do, or they might, but then they might not sell them either, or, you know, hold out for a better price or whatnot. But like I said, these guys aren't going to be buying equities, right? So they might buy, they might say, okay, well, I sold my bonds. I'm going to replace them with another bond somewhere else on the curve. Mm-hmm. Or maybe a mortgage bond, or maybe a high grade bond. But the guys from whom the Fed is buying don't have it in their mandate to buy Nvidia or Tesla, right? So it's not like people have this idea that they're pumping money into the financial system, and they're pumping money into the settlement system, a very different animal. So that banks have enough money they're not pumping any wealth into the system. They're basically allowing you to have more money in the cash register in case you have a moment where everyone rushes to liquidate their bonds for cash. That's all it really is. And that's why it doesn't really have any effect. Now, down the road, like I said, people might decide to go from their 60-40 allocation to a 70-30 on their own. It doesn't matter if they're holding T-bills or deposits at the Fed, right? If their risk appetite increases for whatever reason, they can do that. But that's what it takes. The act of changing the nature of your fixed income portfolio doesn't change that 40% allocation, right? And it's not going to likely to change it. You might, like I said, like we were saying, you might buy some mortgages instead, or you might buy some other kind of high quality fixed income. But that's that effect where it goes out the curve, out the risk spectrum, kind of stops in the fixed income market. It's not very powerful. And I think we've seen that. Like I said, if it were that powerful, we wouldn't be seeing stocks at all-time highs. I mean, just think about it. If you're on margin, it doesn't matter what the Fed does, right? No one's going to pull your margin. It's your decision, right? So think about the mechanics of if the Fed sells a bunch of bonds or lets a bunch of bonds mature and they take in the cash, who does that affect? It just, right? It doesn't affect, it really doesn't affect, it doesn't affect bank lending. It only affects potentially bank settlement, and the banks have to figure out what they need for settlement purposes. So the distinction between, you know, stimulus and plumbing is extremely important. And I think a lot of people don't make it when they're analyzing what the Fed is doing and why.
So yeah, the Federal Reserve has immense influence in plumbing issues. 99% and probably much higher than 99% of the time are fine. It's just that when there's a crisis, the Federal Reserve can fix that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And I agree. If QE had a huge impact on the economy, we would have had a boom after the Great Financial Crisis. We didn't. But what about on sort of those interest rate sectors or the asset? Like if you're a huge, you know, I think Bank of America had $500 trillion in treasuries and agency mortgage-backed securities, at least. Like they probably care about whether the Federal Reserve is buying or selling 80 billion of those or 95 billion of those a month, right? Like it has like...
No, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. That's probably the area where it has the most impact. Is in the mortgage-backed securities market, right?
Yeah,
that's where it has the most impact because it's a smaller market than treasuries. But it's not enough to drive the economy. It's not enough to it certainly doesn't explain why stocks go up and all those other kind of things. Because as I say, we've seen if it were just a matter of it lowers the discount rate and people discount the earnings and they come up with a higher number and they bid the price up, we wouldn't have had the rally we just had in 2023. It wouldn't have happened. So it's really, it's these animal spirits and it's less these rational calculations of discounting this and that. It's really people saying, I want to buy risk because it's going up. And look at the multiples on Microsoft and Apple, any of those names, the multiples, much less the earnings, are higher than they were before QT started.
Well, yeah, in that mid-spring window of 2020,
there was a dip, but that dip,
the peak prices, they're not higher than at the peak. I don't think the peak was January 4th, 2022. I think.
There might have been a brief moment, yeah, but if you look at on average where the multiples are now compared to where they've been in history, they're if not at the highest, they're close to. They're very high. They're much higher. Put it this way, than anyone would have ever forecast if they thought interest rates.
Absolutely.
And QT mattered. And I think that's the biggest piece of evidence. None of the things that, you know, term premium, multiples, none of that stuff really played out. So it just says these other factors matter a lot more. And I like I said, all the story about shadow QE, Janet Yellen, that's fatuous stuff by guys making up reasons to cover for having been wrong.
Yes, I do know some guys who have been right and think that Janet Yellen is doing that, but definitely, and you know, I'm going to compliment anonymously and also criticize anonymously, but you know, but those people.
But think about okay, there was one moment where people ascribed the market tanking to the Treasury announcement, but there were other factors going on as well, and we had a, you know, like I said, post hoc ergo propter hoc, that over time tells the story, right? And supply in Treasuries hasn't abated. Interest rates have gone higher, QT has proceeded, and none of those things have happened. They might have happened for short windows.
Yeah.
So if you want to say someone is tactically right about something, that's fine. But the bigger thesis, I think you can reject it by now. I remember saying in 2000, at the depths of 2022, like in August or September, October was the absolute depth, but around that area, I kind of put a tweet out saying, okay, if we make all-time highs by the end of 2023, we can pretty much say that the whole QT is dragging down the market and interest rates drive everything. That thesis is dead. And people were willing to say, okay, at that time, because they didn't think it would happen. I didn't even know if it would happen. I wasn't necessarily predicting it, but I knew it could happen because interest rates and QT didn't matter that much. And indeed, it ended up happening. So we've got, it's one of those things where there's that old economist joke where they say, okay, fine. So it works in practice, but does it work in theory? And so everyone has kind of stuck on their theory, but they're not realizing that their theory didn't work in practice.
Mark, what are your views on the market right now? You've been very bullish. And I think I've seen you say multiple times on Twitter throughout this rally that the easy money is about to be made, and then it is, and then you keep on
I like to say that, but I think right now the story for me is that the things that went parabolic in February and March need to correct. right? And they need to correct further. So whether it's NVIDIA or SMCI or coins or whatnot, it got a little bit out over its skis. It didn't feel quite like the end of 2021, but kind of close. So I think those need to correct. But the other areas of the market should do really well. Nominal GDP is still strong. People are grasping for reasons to be bearish and about credit deterioration and things. Those things could happen, and we have to be on watch for them. But if you think about a situation where unemployment is really low, growth is good and not showing signs of abating. Inflation isn't all the way down to target, but we'll see whether or not that continues. And the Fed has a lot of ammunition to cut, even though I don't think it's that powerful or matters that much. A lot of other people do, and it creates that that placebo effect. So I think there are no reasons to be bearish. Yeah, people will sell before tax day, and it's an election year, so we might get noise. But the underlying fundamentals are pretty strong, so I'd want to be bullish on the things that are linked to the underlying economy. Some of the stuff that's run really hard, that obviously you can see some head and shoulder tops, as a technician would say, in some of the names like, you know, MSTR and COIN and NVIDIA and SMCI. Those are kind of the poster boys, as it were, for this phenomenon. I think those guys need to correct more. But the rest, I think we're good. You know, if you're a long-term investor, there's not a lot to be afraid of. And I know it's surprisingly hard to say that, because you look like a total fool if there's a 10% correction. It's always sounds a lot better to say, oh, I'm worried about this, and these things could happen. Yeah, they could happen, but I just don't think it makes a lot of sense to bet that they will. You know, you wait for signs of weakness first, rather than anticipate it, because markets tend to go up over time. A lot of investing, Jack, is protecting us from ourselves, right? I'm a discretionary trader. I've been doing this for a while, so I have systems to protect me from my biases, right? You know, all kinds of technical things. For a lot of people who don't have the time or the inclination, dollar cost averaging, or, you know, setting up a 60-40 portfolio with periodic rebalancing, low cost, high tax efficiency, that makes sense for most people.
Mark, I was going to say, how do you square? Because when I hear you criticizing or critiquing the mono focus on monetary policy, the Fed is the only thing to matters. It sounds, you know, like you're going against witchcraft in the cause of rationality. But then I also see that you're this big chart guy who's doing a lot of technical analysis. At least maybe it's my bias, the way that I was raised, you know, studying Warren Buffett and stuff. I don't think of it as super rational. Obviously, I've interviewed technical analysts who I have a lot of respect for.
How do I square these?
Yeah. How do you square these? Do you think it is rational, or are you just doing it because...
It's not rational. It's revealed preference. So I'm trying to read what other people believe to be the case from the price action and from the correlations, right? So a little bit like I was saying earlier, we had higher valuations in 2000 than we did at the peak in 2021, but interest rates were higher. That's telling me interest rates aren't so, you know, there's information that interest rates really aren't the determinant of things. Well, you can look at the correlation between gold and real rates when that breaks down. So that's a form of technical analysis. I look at those things to inform me what other people believe. And then I try and match that to a narrative. Is that something, this is what I do on behavioral macro a lot. You know, is there, for example, a positioning gets really skewed to one side. And, you know, can I see a narrative? Because sooner or later, you know, the pendulum swings back and forth, right? We get too optimistic, we get too pessimistic. That's, you know, around some notion of equilibrium. And when we get too far to one side or another, as we did recently in these stocks that went parabolic, I say, okay, can I imagine this a narrative where these things correct, right? And so that's kind of how I think about it. It's not whether the markets are rational or irrational. It's, can I extract from the chart patterns and the correlations and my understanding of how these assets typically behave what the market believes to be the case? And then I can judge whether or not I think that's correct. And then rather than, if you think the market's incorrect, you won't necessarily want to bet on it immediately. You want to wait until that narrative starts to get exhausted and show signs of reversing before you jump on it. So that's kind of how I marry my fundamental analysis with my technical analysis. I use it to reveal to me what other people believe to be the case.
And so if you're someone who, you know, I mean this as obviously not as an insult, but you know, greater fool theory, basically, oh, I'm going to buy this at 130 because someone else is going to think that it broke out above 130. Why not buy something like Bitcoin or trade Bitcoin on the long or short side? I think you maybe are short some Bitcoin or something.
In this moment, I actually am. I haven't been for a while, but I have been since this morning. And I've been short MSTR, which is a proxy Bitcoin, for about a week now. And it's been a great trade, but yeah. So the way I look at it is, the other thing you see in patterns is you see repeated behaviors. So to just say something really banal that everyone can relate to, you know, a lot of people say, well, I'll sell it when it gets back to the level where I bought it. Now that's not good investing, but a lot of people feel that. You can see that behavior in chart patterns. When we return to a level that something broke down from, that's typically overhead resistance. And it's usually not going to run straight through it. If it's headed higher, it's going to have to back and fill and work its way higher. So you see repeated behaviors. And it's not like, yeah, you just see patterns. You say, okay, I see this, like the gold pattern recently. I said, this gold pattern is going to break higher. It's going to break sharply higher, because it had built up a lot of pressure at a resistance level that it had run into several times. So it's just by force of having seen these patterns time and time and time and time and time again, and being able to map them to human biases, to our cognitive shortcomings. It's based on us being inefficient, but it's reading the charts to extract the information of how we're being inefficient and why. For example, I don't use Fibonacci lines or anything like that, because I can't map that to human behavior. The charts I look at and the patterns, if I can see that, I say, I can map that to behavior, and I can map that to a narrative, then it makes sense to me. So whether or not the underlying rationale is efficient or not, right? I've bought speculative assets just because they look like they were going to explode, and not for any other reason. Now, if I have a fundamental belief, I might bet larger and I might set my stop a little bit wider. If I don't believe in it fundamentally, then I'm going to take a smaller position and I'm going to have a tighter stop.
Do you always have stops when you trade, Mark?
Pretty much, yeah. One form or another, I do. I don't. The real key to me, you know, I always say that you can be a good trader without knowing much about the fundamentals, but you can't be a good trader if you don't know much about risk management. And it's not about, a lot of people say, well, I'll just be right on the thesis. That doesn't, you need strategies that protect you from yourself.
No, absolutely. I mean, I've shorted stocks that don't exist anymore. They were delisted that I've lost money shorting them.
Yeah, it can happen. I mean, I can't even tell you. I remember 2021, I was too early shorting ARKK, and I got hurt a little bit, and it ended up going down massively, right? I was just, my timing was off, and I stopped out several times, and my typical people on behavioral macro see this, but I stop out, I'll take a couple shots at it where I lose a little bit each time, and I think if I'm up at bat four times, my odds of getting a hit improve significantly, so I try and keep my losses short, but I tried so many times with ARK, I finally gave up because I wasn't making it. And then, of course, as soon as I gave up, then it collapsed. I mean, so this stuff happens.
Yeah, that always happens.
Happens to all of us.
What do you think is harder, trading or investing? And by investing, I mean like stock picking and then holding them for a really long time.
For me, investing is much harder because it's just harder to predict the future. And there are people who spend 24/7 analyzing these companies and their moats and their margins and their management. And I don't know how you can possibly get an edge against these people. So for me, trading is a lot easier, shorter time frames with more concentrated positions, sometimes even leveraged. So if a stock is going to move 15%, if just catching the first half of that move is enough, you know, get out while the trend is still powerful sometimes. But bet more aggressively. That means you have to have a tighter stop if you're wrong, right? So you have to pick your setups pretty carefully. But that's easier than trying to ride a trend to the absolute last point, because how long the trend persists is a function of a lot of things that are really hard to forecast. There are other techniques too. So you can overclock a position when you're putting it on. You think there's going to be a breakout. You put on an extra large position and you peel off half of it after it's had that first 7% move. And then you ride the rest with your stop. So there are techniques to help you ride things further. But as a general proposition, to get that the meat of the move right? Not to be the first guy to buy or not to be the last guy to sell, to get that meat of that move with a concentrated position, for me personally, is the easiest way to trade.
Well, Mark, thanks so much for coming on, being so generous with your time and insights. People can find your private Twitter, Behavioral Macro, and then your public Twitter, Mark_Dow. I saw you quote tweet respond to my friend Citrini, who I've interviewed before. He said, basically, what's one ticker that you have and what's your thesis for it? And you mentioned a ticker HOV. And I want to disclose, I do not own this stock, and I presume you do. And it's a small cap stock, so, you know, people should be careful and do their own research, obviously. But what's your view on this?
You know, basically, this is a company that almost went bankrupt a number of years ago. They, in the global financial crisis, like all the other home builders, they were out over their skis, but they weren't in as bad a shape as the others, and they started buying land too quickly, and they almost didn't make it. And there was a point where people thought they were going to go bankrupt. I looked at it, and I said, this doesn't look like a bankruptcy to me, so I bought the stock, and I've been involved off and on since. But what's happening now is they've been paying down their debt, and they're doing a great job, but they're now at the point where they can return to growth, so they don't have to dedicate all of their earnings to paying down the debt. And like all the home builders, they have demand on tap because what I was saying earlier, there's a massive housing shortage. The post-traumatic stress disorder of the GFC caused people to underbuild for a long time. And because they have an advantage over banks, they can pay down the mortgages for the people buying homes from them better than the banks can. They can basically build as much as they want. And I like a lot of the different home builders, but this one has a lot of financial leverage. And when things are going well and something has financial leverage, it does a lot better, right? Then it does worse when things go poorly, but it does better when things go well. So that's kind of the thinking behind it. But all the home builders should do well. We have a really bad housing shortage, and it's going to take a long time to fill.
Yeah. So it's basically a very high beta and levered home builder, which if home builder does well, it will do well. And if you know, home builders don't do well, it won't do well. Obviously, people should do their own research and risk manage their own views. Mark, I think the thing about which I have been wrong the most in the way that you've been talking about focusing too much on monetary policy is the home builders. I mean, I, like many people, to be fair, consider it almost a shoe-in that the housing market would suffer, and it did in terms of new listings and activity as interest rates rose, but the prices really, you know, they went down a little bit and now they're stabilizing, going back up.
And I think even when the supply comes back online, they're not going to go down meaningfully. They might in some areas more than others or whatever, but it's really been more of a COVID phenomenon than a monetary policy phenomenon. But I think so many people were conditioned, the combination of the GFC and the belief of how monetary policy pumped up the housing market, and that combination led a lot of people astray. And like I was saying, this being able to not, you know, not fearing monetary policy the way others do has over the past 15 years just been the single most important. I mean, it's just been huge, single most important thing. And I think for the home builders, that's you have the added bonus of the scar tissue from the last time around. I don't think now people are still looking for the kind of crash they were looking for a year or so ago. But I think home builders are at the point where they have to put up the numbers, right? People realize home builders aren't going to die, and home prices probably aren't going to go down a ton. But the home builders have to start putting up the earnings numbers to get to the next level. Their valuations are very low, and I think that when people start seeing the numbers, it will change.
Mark, thanks again for coming on, and thanks everyone for watching.
Thanks for having me, Jack. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for watching. Remember to check out vanek.com/HODLFG to learn more about the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL.